this lady as any teeth.
Hi. Hi, my name is Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome all the new people here tonight, and especially our person that had 60 days, and especially people who are here for the first year in sobriety. It's real important. I'd also like to wish you a happy birthday. Birthdays are really important, especially when they're mine. Norm, you didn't have a blackout, you had a whiteout. I'd like to thank Norm for inviting me here and the committee for asking me to come up here. It was a time in my life people were telling me to keep on going. They weren't inviting me anywhere. And he had a hard time catching me. I'm really a hard person to catch. I mean, if you don't catch me early in the morning, you don't catch me. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to wonder, what am I going to do? This is going to be boring. And I really enjoyed the meeting. Before the meeting, I'd also like to thank all of you who shared. I'd like to thank you for making a 12-step call on me tonight. And that's where I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I come here because I'm not all there, you know, and I got to keep coming back here to get my spirit fed. I celebrated 25 years on June 16th of this past year, and you may not be impressed, but I'm really impressed. I'm really impressed. I'm really impressed because I really hadn't planned to stay here quite this long. And one of my favorite speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous who's gone today is Norm Alpe. And I just, if any of you ever get the opportunity or if you can pick up a tape here tonight, if he's got one of him, he's got a tremendous message for the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Norm was, Norm walked like he talked. And Norm always told you how long he was sober. And the reason why he told you how long he was sober, he said the reason is because there's so many things happening in Alcoholics Anonymous today. There's a lot of changes in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And he said, one day you might get a pension plan going here. And he wanted to get his full benefit. You know? So just in case you get a pension plan going here, I want to get my full benefit here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really good to see my friend Don P. I'm not going to be here tomorrow morning to hear him. I'm going to be out of here at 6 o'clock in the morning. In fact, I hope it's not foggy. But, you know, I don't get scared of flying because I just figure, you know, if it's my time, it's my time. You know, it's just that, you know, that's the way it is. I always make sure I take an inventory before I leave town. Make those amends. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on June 16th. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous before that. I'd come here in 1967. And I looked around AA at that time, and I was 23 years of age when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I looked around, and everybody was old. I mean, they were 35 and older, you know. I mean, really old. I mean, they looked like they had one foot in the grave and the other banana peel and ready to slide in any second. And I just could not imagine life without drinking, you know. And I thought, my God, I can't stay here, you know. I mean, these people are 40 years old. 40! Can you imagine? And I projected immediately, and I didn't know anything about projection, but I projected immediately into being 40 and sitting in these hard chairs. You know, that was part of the punishment for being an alcoholic. So I graduated from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I left. I failed to hear. If you're new here tonight, I failed to hear this. You know, they told me to go to meetings and not drink. But I failed to hear it. You don't drink in between meetings. You know, I didn't know that. I didn't know that you couldn't drink in between meetings. So I was still drinking. So I can't honestly say that I was sober. And so I went out and I got drunk. And I came back. My husband and I put him in the hospital. And he came home from the hospital. And he said, you're drunk again. And I said, well, you know, I've been going down there every Tuesday night. It was the only meeting I was going to. I didn't know I was supposed to go to any more than that one. And I said, then they, you know, everybody is so happy. They were all so happy. And I heard a lot about laughter here tonight. And everybody was just so happy. And I thought, you know, I don't know. They've got to be doing something. You know, they can't be that happy and not do something. And I kept waiting for them to share it with me. You know, they had to share it. You know, they had to be taking pills or something. And I said, I just got tired of waiting, so I went out and got my own, you know. And so he explained to me that that was not Alcoholics Anonymous. The Alcoholics Anonymous was a place where the people, you know, stopped drinking, and they did it a day at a time. And so I left, and I drank for 8 more months. And I am really, really grateful. And I'd like to stand up here and tell you I'm one of these people that do that. And, you know, when new people come in and you get their phone numbers or you work with them for a little while and then they go back out. But this gal worked with me and she, And when I went back out, she kept calling me, and I don't do that. I don't follow up. If they don't show up and they don't, and I sounds awful, but I don't do it. You know, I did it for a little while, and I get discouraged. But this gal kept calling me. It was Carolyn C., and she'd call me up, and she would say things like, "How are you doing?" And I'd immediately tell her, "Oh, I had 3 drinks today. I had to get that out, you know, and just let her know I only had 3, you know." And she'd say to me, "I'm not interested in your drinking, Annie. I really don't care if you're drinking. I want to be your friend. And God, I long for a friend, and I needed a friend. But I didn't want to be her friend because she wanted to go to these lousy AA meetings. My God." So I'd go off the phone, and I'd think, and I'd say, "Yeah, I bet she wants to be my friend. The only reason she wants to be my friend is because she wants me to go to meetings, and I'm not an alcoholic." And so I decided what it was a recruiting thing. I would recruit somebody for you, get you off my case. You know, and I thought, I was really proud of myself. I called this friend of mine in Long Beach, and I said, "Eileen, you're an alcoholic, and you ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "Okay," you know. And so I called this gal back up, and I said, "I found somebody for you." And she said, "Good." She said, "I'll come and get both of you, you know." How do you tell somebody with a whole year and a half sobriety, "I just want you to take Eileen and leave me alone," you know? And so she came and took both of us. She took us over to the old Anaheim Club over in Anaheim. And after the meeting, there was another gal there, and her name was Sue M. And Sue M. came up to me after the meeting. She said, "Annie, when are you coming back?" And I said, "I'm not an alcoholic. She is. Look at her," you know? And I walked out that door. And but every time I picked up a drink, and when I look back on that time, I one more time see how God has always had his hand, you know, in my life. And every time I picked up a drink from that time on, I would hear that woman say, "When are you coming back?" And when I got ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what got me ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous was alcohol. Alcohol got me ready. It beat me. It beat me to death. And I lost everything. And I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about everything inside of me, because I didn't have any material things when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was all used up. And so when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to tell you, I walked in here and I said, "I'm surrendered, and I'm going to look at those 12 steps, and I'm going to work those steps, and I'm going to do everything you tell me." And that would be a lie. You know, I came in here and I was very angry and very hostile, and I walked around my first year of sobriety, and I gave everybody the finger, and I cussed you up one side and down the other. I couldn't put a sentence together without using 4-letter words. And you know, I talked one time, I was about 3 years sober over in Glendale for Bob Lemke, and I was a 10-minute speaker. I was with my friend Angie, and Angie was the main speaker, and so they pushed me up at the podium, and Bob Lemke told me I'd never, never, never talk again at Alcoholics Anonymous. He said the paint came off the walls. Yeah, with some of the language I used, and I could not talk. I could not talk. I couldn't put a sentence together, like I said, without using 4-letter words. And so I knew that they were going to ask me to leave, and they didn't. They didn't ask me to leave. They told me to keep coming back. And I was real disappointed when I found out they're telling everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous to keep coming back. You know, I thought they just kind of singled me out, the whole group. You know. And I got involved with a group of people down there in Huntington Beach, and I am really, really, truly grateful to those people that were there for me, that gave me my foundation into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a group of people, and on Friday night, I went to a lot of meetings, but Friday night was my home group, and I used to tell them that God sent me to teach them patience and tolerance, and a lot of them used to look and think, "I didn't think he did, you know, I really believe he did." And there were people who talked about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talked about the 12 traditions of AA, and they talked about getting active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They also talked about cleaning house. And I want you to know I had one of the cleanest houses in Alcoholics Anonymous until they found out what I was doing. You know, and they said, "That's not the kind of house cleaning we have in mind for you, Annie." You know, the kind of house cleaning we have in mind for you is an inside job, you know. And I wondered where these steps were, you know. They talk about these 12 steps, and I had visions. You know, I understand today, it took me a long time to understand, when the old-timer would say, "Bring the body, the mind will follow." I think I was here all of 6 years when all of me arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I would bring the body, and I'd sit, and I would be here for the first 5 minutes, and my head would just kind of trip out there, you know. And so all of me arrived and stayed when I was about 6 years sober, and I heard the traditions, I heard chapter 5, and I heard it all, and I thought, my God, this is what they mean. I kind of pinched myself. It was one of those little miracles. I thought I couldn't, visions of these 12 stone steps somewhere, and I ran into a meeting one night. My hair is red again. I've done it many different colors throughout the years. I found out that, you know, I used to they'd say it's an inside job, not an outside. You know, when I'm going through problems, I change the whole look, you know. Dye the hair, cut it off, and, you know, just change it, you know. And I had to learn that, you know, that doesn't do it, you know. It does it for a little while. And so I used to have brighter red hair than I have now. Can you imagine? It was fire engine red. And used to call me Crazy Annie. Someone asked me tonight, how did you get Irish Annie? And I said, well, I'm Irish, and people just start saying that. It's a lot better than crazy, you know. They used to call me Crazy Annie, and that's what they used to call me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they didn't call it to me behind my back. They called it to me right to my face, you know. I mean, it was no secret, you know. They'd see me come, and they'd say, here comes Crazy. And I ran into a meeting one night when I was about 4 months sober, and I ran up to Jerry Froelich, and Jerry's still sober. He just celebrated 33 years, and I ran up to Jerry, and I said, Jerry, where are those steps? And how often do I have to run up and down them? And Jerry kind of backed off of me, you know, and he kind of looked at me, and he's, you know, he's kind of, oh, God, you know, where is she coming from? And he said, oh, Annie, he said, you know, you go to a lot of meetings, and he said, and every night, he said, you go to a meeting, you hear chapter 5, and he said, you know, if you listen to chapter 5 and how it works and how it stands for honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And he said, willingness is the key. And he said, and then it goes on, and it tells you how to, the steps in there. And he said, if you work the steps, he said, I guarantee you, your life will change. He guaranteed me my life would change. He didn't say it might change or maybe it would change. He guaranteed me. And if you're new here tonight, I'm going to tell you, I guarantee you your life will change. It may not change to the way you want it to change, but it will change. It definitely will change if you stay sober and try to apply the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. And so I tried those steps on, and those steps have meant a lot to me today. Those steps have are the most important thing in my life, because those are the things that are going to see me through. I've gone through a lot of stuff in the last year and a half, and I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in the people in AA, and I believe in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that God has always had his hand on my shoulder. A year and a half ago, it'll be 2 years this November, one of my dearest friends, and if you're new here tonight, and I'm not trying to put a little dent on your conference here or your rally, is the fact that sobriety is really, really important. And, you know, the longer you're sober, it really does not get easier, because you have to stay on top of it. You have to work those steps just as hard, if not harder, the longer you're sober than you do when you're brand new, because the people will carry you when you're new. They will practically carry you. When you get some time in Alcoholics Anonymous and you start having those secrets and you're not, you know, you don't want to look bad in AA, oh my God. I mean, I don't want to look bad. I've got all these years after all. I should know how to figure it out by now. And people go back out, you know, and several of my friends went out. In 1988, four of my friends went out. And one gal had 18 years sobriety and went out and drank. Another one with 17 years went out and drank. The guy with 22 years. And the guy with 22 years is dead today. And the other gal with 18 years is still out there. And the other gal with 17 years made it back. And a lot of people don't, it's harder to get back here when you get some time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my dearest friends, Johanna, and I know a lot of you have heard her, and Johanna found it necessary to go out, and I got the opportunity to work with her and be there. And you know, that denial that all of us do, and we see it, and I knew it. I knew there was something up, and I confronted her a couple of times and asked her what she was doing, and she kept denying it. And she kept saying, I'm not doing anything. And it was all right laid out there in front of me until she finally drank. And I was it took a whole year, and it was real painful, real painful. And I lived where I practiced, and if you pick up any of my tapes, you'll listen to the saga of my marriage for years. And I my husband is not the type of drunk like I am. He's a very quiet, boring type. I like bright music and loud, and like to run from bar to bar to find whatever it is I'm looking for. And just run those streets and get to Vegas and do whatever you have to do in order to get that excitement. He just likes to sit in front of the TV and kind of watch that tube and just say nothing, boring, not colorful at all. And So a lot of people had told me I had to give up on Johanna and stop going over there, and I couldn't give up. I couldn't give up. And I want to report to you tonight that Johanna's got 9 months of sobriety. She's clean and she's sober and she's doing real well. And it's got nothing to do with me. It's got to do with that it was her time, one more time, and I hope she stays. It's been real difficult in the last 9 months. But out of that whole deal was that working with her, I was going home and watching this man drink. And 2 years, like I said, November, I asked him to pour me a drink. And something clicked in my head, and I said, you know, and that's because of the people, and that's because of the foundation I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it said, you get up and you move, and you get down, move out of the area you're at. And I got up and I moved out of the area, and I got scared, and I sat in the bathroom, and I sat in the toilet, and I just sat there, and I said, God, please help me, because I don't know what to do, and I can't move forward, and I'm afraid, I'm so afraid, because I tried to leave the situation many times, and I couldn't do it. And it took my children, and it took a lot of them, going to a lot of meetings. So I kept going to meetings because I was raised as an Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised on page 20. As an ex-problem drinker, I must have constant thoughts of others and their needs. And that's how I was raised in AA. That was drummed into me, and I really didn't give a rat's you know what about your needs. I was always worried about my needs. And I know today that if I'm thinking about your needs, I'm not looking down at my belly button worrying about what I'm not getting. And my oldest daughter, I didn't drink, and I went to another meeting, and I talked to people, and I talked to my sponsor, and did inventories, and I couldn't move. And finally, I thought suicide is the only way out of this. And something happened. One morning I got up, and I was crying, and my oldest girl took me in her arms, and she's 27 years of age, and she said, Mommy, she said, Dad's got a problem with drinking, and he's an alcoholic, and he's not going to change. And I'm so scared that you're going to commit suicide, and you've got such a full life. And I do have a full life. Because, you see, when I get into the spaces like that, what I say is I've got no friends. There's nobody that cares. And there's a lot of people that care. And so I called my youngest daughter down in San Diego, and I said, I don't know what to do, and I know what I just can't stand living the way I'm living anymore. And she said, Mom, she said, you know, Dad's got a problem with drinking. And what you don't have is you don't have a relationship. And you do have friends. You've got a lot of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suggest you stop feeling sorry for yourself and go to a meeting of AA. And I thought, you know, I didn't need to hear this from you. I could have called another AA member up and got the same story. So it took a little time, and I moved. I moved, it'll be a year and a half, and I'm on my own. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions, and it's not been an easy deal. And, you know, it's real difficult to work with someone who's drinking because he's not willing to give up anything. And, you know, they kind of drag their feet, you know. Yeah, I'm going to do that one of these days, you know. And one of these days, I might just find it necessary to go up there and kill them. So I've been doing real good, and God is doing, I was moved. I literally was moved. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I just need to tell you this where I'm at today, you know. I didn't realize, and I don't think you realize until you get out of a situation, until you get away from it. And this man's a good man. He's a wonderful man. You know, he raised me. I pulled a lot of stuff on this man. It was, you know, I was necessary for me to stay the 26 years I stayed. Because nobody else would ever put up some of the stuff I pulled. And I pulled some good stuff. Drunk and sober, you know. I mean, I didn't walk in here and become an angel. I came in here and I had a lot of stuff I had to work through. And it's just that he has this problem, and my sobriety has to come first. I have to stay sober. I've seen too many of my friends going back out there, and someone don't make it back. And I've got to stay sober. And that's what I was told when I was new. If anything is going to interfere with your sobriety, they've got to go. And it doesn't matter whether it's a husband, whether it's a girlfriend, whether it's children, or whatever. It's going to interfere with your sobriety. Because if I don't have my sobriety, I have absolutely nothing. Nothing. I might as well go to the bartender and say, here, take it all. And I have earned a lot of stuff here in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not willing to give up. And I'd like to go back now and really fill you in where I come from. And I didn't come from I'm made up of a lot of people here in Alcoholics Anonymous is what I'm made up of. When I did that inventory and I did work those steps, and I continue to work those steps to the best of my ability in my life today. And I took my first inventory, and I've taken lots of inventory. But I want to share with you what I learned in that first inventory. Now, don't get excited. You're not going to get it. You're just going to get it in a general way. You know, I just won't give you. I used to give details. I don't give details anymore. I've had to learn the hard way. Yeah. I go back to, and I share this part of my life simply because I really believe, for me, this is where it started. You know, it really started back here and this time for me. And I don't, if you listen and if you hear that I still got resentments or I'm angry or I'm blaming, I used to blame and I was angry and it was their fault. And I believe today that I've learned to take responsibility for myself and do for anything I do, I take responsibility for it. I'm Irish and I'm Catholic. That gave me two strikes against me right off the bat. You know, and I'm not one of those Irish that's never seen the skies of Ireland. I lived there for 17 years of my life. And my father, I've come from a very large family. There's 10 children. I'm the 8th child out of 10. Now, I was raised in the school of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you don't label someone else an alcoholic. And I've listened to enough men and talked to enough men in Alcoholics Anonymous and enough women in AA that I would say that my father definitely had a problem with alcohol. And on Saturday night or Friday night, he would go out to Flanagan's and he would get drunk. And he'd come home and he would pull my mother out of that bed and he would beat on her. And that was kind of a tradition in Ireland. You know, you just kind of got to whip that woman in shape. You know, I understand today the women are now beating the hell out of men in Ireland. You know, I guess women's lib. I guess women's lib has finally hit Ireland, you know. It was kind of a custom. It wasn't just happening in my house. It was happening all over in Ireland, you know. And I just thought it was happening in my house. And the only thing my mother ever did, the worst thing she ever did, was she had too many goddamn kids. You know, there was 10 of us. It was just too many kids. That's the only thing that woman ever did. So there was a lot of fighting going on, and I would be upstairs in that room, and I would put the pillow over my head, and I'd be praying to that God. I was terrified of God, absolutely terrified of him, because he was a punishing God, or I was learning about it. And I knew by the time I was 7 years of age, I was going to go to hell, and I thought, we might as well go all the way, you know? I mean, it's done. It's a done deal. And I would be praying to him because I was afraid not to pray to him, and I'd be asking him to please let him kill her, or maybe she'll kill him, or maybe I will die. And I got the next morning, I had all these things going on inside of me, and I never knew how to label them until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because that when you're 5 and 6 years of age, it's really difficult to process some of those things. And what it was guilt, remorse, and I was a really bad child for thinking these bad things of my parents. I went to Catholic school, not because we're rich, simply because that's all there is in a part of Ireland I come from. And people used to say to me, how come you didn't get an education and went to Catholic school? And I used to come back and say, I had frustrated Irish nuns. You know. And you see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to read, nor did I know how to write. And it's got absolutely nothing to do with my alcoholism. It's got to do with the setting I came from and where I came from. And because the people didn't know what was wrong with me. And again, Alcoholics Anonymous saw a woman, her name was Mary Jane, and she was a school teacher. And Mary Jane taught in special education. And we were at a picnic up in Irvine one time for the Orange County Central Office, and Mary Jane was sitting with me, and she knew that I felt really different. And you know, we all come in here and we all think our cases is different, and I knew that my case was definitely more different than yours. And that difference would have made me get back out there again, and I would have died from alcoholism. And Mary Jane started to teach me with numbers and teach me how to do letters. And she found a doctor over in Orange County, a psychiatrist in the educational field, and they tested me and what they came up with. And I've had my head tested more ways than I care to tell you. I mean, I've got little pieces of paper and little tapes and all kinds of things. And what they came up with was that I've got a thing called dyslexia, and I see everything in reverse. And they say that I have a perception problem. I don't perceive things like a normal people perceive them. Now, they tell me that alcoholism is a disease of the perception. Now, I come by mine real honestly. I don't know what the rest of you are doing here tonight, you know. I am truly, truly grateful that alcoholism does not choose its victims. It really doesn't care whether you have an education or you don't have an education, or you're overeducated or you're undereducated. If you have the disease of alcoholism, you have the disease of alcoholism. It's just that simple. And so I went to Catholic school, and I didn't want to be different. I couldn't tell that nun that when I saw a B, I thought it was a D. You know, I mean, I could not tell her that I didn't want to be any more different in that classroom than the rest of those children in that classroom. And I used to have to memorize this catechism. And with all the stuff that went on in our household, I mean, it was a lot of fighting. It was it was a small house, and there were 6 boys and 4 girls, and my mom and dad. And it was, you know, when the Irish are telling you they love you, they're usually throwing you across the other end of the room. And there was a lot of anxiety because there was not enough of anything. There was not enough food. There was not enough money. There was not enough clothes. There wasn't enough. Yeah, because there was hard times. And it wasn't just my family. Everybody's family was that way. But I didn't know that. For a long time, I didn't know that. And so I was so afraid, and I couldn't memorize this catechism. And this one day, I went into class, and I decided I was going to get sister. You know, I wanted to brainstorm to talk about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, I'm going to get her before she gets me today. And so I sat down, and she asked me the question in the catechism, and I couldn't answer. And she grabbed a hold of me, and she pulled me out of that seat, and I up and slapped her as hard as any little second grader can hit somebody across the face. So I got her. And there's a last petition in this particular classroom, and Mother Superior just happened to be teaching that particular day, and she just happened to turn her head, and she just happened to see me do it, and she came flying into that room, and she grabbed a hold of me, and she kind of shook me by the back of the neck. She grabbed me by the back of the neck and kind of shook me. And I stood there in front of 30 kids, and Mother Superior, and said, I didn't do it. You know, I did not do it, because I couldn't take responsibility for that. And I did that, and so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't care what I got caught doing. I would stand and say, not me. It's got to be somebody else. I did not do that, you know. And I have learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous to take responsibility for myself. They took me out of there and moved me to another grade, and I assumed I was supposed to pray because the Irish went for big statues, and I was in front of these two big statues, and I was kneeling there, and they had hardwood floors, and it was big knots on the floor. And I always say 3 weeks. It probably was a week, but it felt like 3 weeks when you're in second grade. And the nun wants me to apologize to that class, and I ain't going to apologize to that class. I'm not going to tell them I'm sorry. And so I got tired of kneeling on these hardwood floors, and I went back up to the classroom, and I stood in front of all those kids, and sister had that round pointer, and she's sticking in my back, and she wants me to say I'm sorry. And she wants to say I'm sorry out loud. And I don't want to say I'm sorry. My eyes are lowered, and as she sticks me in the back with that round pointer, I said, I'm sorry. And something else happened inside of me. And what happened inside of me was you against me, and it was always you against me from that time on. I tell you this time of my life simply because I really believe that if I had not found alcohol, I would have gone absolute stark raving mad. Alcohol saved my sanity until the day it turned on me and it didn't work anymore. And through Alcoholics Anonymous and rooms like this and people like you and the big book of AA, you've made me a whole person here today. I spent most of my time in Dunce's Corners and standing outside doors, and I used to have psychiatrists cry about my early childhood and what happened to me growing up in this Irish family and these horrible, horrible nuns that I had. And I remember sitting with Mary Reagan one day, and I was telling Mary the sad, sad story about my life. And Mary looked at me and she said, honey, she said, you know, you really had it bad. She said, you know, I had German nuns, and they were trained by Hitler. So always somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to have it just a little bit worse than you, you know, the bottom line. I left school when I was 13 years of age, and I had all those hopes and dreams that every other girl has. I was going to find me a nice Irish fella and get married and have kids, and I am truly, truly grateful God does not answer stupid prayers. I found boys and I found alcohol all in the same week, and I remember my first drink and I remember my last drink, and my first drink was at the Abbey Ballroom in Drogheda. And this guy had a half a bottle of cognac, and he told me that if I drank this half a bottle of cognac, he would give me a pound note, which was equivalent to $3 in your money at that time. And the deal was I was to drink this half a bottle of cognac down. I wasn't to stop, and I drank that half a bottle of cognac down, and they didn't stop. And I went in the bathroom, I got very, very sick, and I threw up, and I came back out, and I said, give me my money. And he gave me that $3. And I went up to the bar, and I ordered me another drink, because if you know anything about my culture, you don't have to be any age in order to order a drink. If you know how to order it, they will serve it to you. I didn't know that I sold my soul for $3 that day. I didn't know that that's exactly what I did. And I went up to the bar and I had another drink and I got drunk that night, and I can tell you exactly what that drink did for me. It took away that knot in the pit of my gut, and it didn't matter whether my father was beating on my mother. It didn't matter whether I had no education. It didn't matter whether there was no food in that house. I found the secret of living. Now, I didn't drink every day from that time on, but I drank at every opportunity from that time on. By the time I was 17 years of age, my father made a decision for me. I had absolutely nothing to do with this decision. He decided I should go to California because the streets were paved with gold. I'm going to be there 32 years this November, and I'm still looking for those streets paved with gold. Now, I had never been anywhere in Ireland. As far as I've ever gotten, Ireland was Dublin at the zoo. I've seen more of Ireland since I've been sober than I ever did when I lived there. And all of a sudden, he sent me to the other ends of the earth. And you see, I didn't know even then that this was alcoholic thinking. It was going to be different. It was going to be different. And that's alcoholic thinking. It's always going to be different somewhere else. I was never going to tell a soul I was Irish. Nobody was ever going to know I was Irish. Now, I had a brogue like I just stepped off the bloody boat, but nobody was ever going to know I was Irish. I like being Irish today because I really believe if it wasn't for us Irish, you could hold your AA meetings in a phone booth. You know? I know a lot of people don't like to hear that. You don't have to be Irish in order to become a member. It just helps. My sponsor told me that the reason why God created whiskey, he was afraid the Irish were going to take over the world, so he thought he'd slow them down just a little bit, you know. My aunt took me up to Dublin and filled out all these papers and got me ready to come to this country. And I remember going up to Dublin Airport, and I remember drinking, and my dad let me have a drink. I remember getting on that plane, and I remember drinking champagne. I remember the feeling. The feeling was freedom. I wanted to be free. I wanted to be free more than anything in my life. I wanted to be free. And it was a false feeling of freedom. It was a feeling of freedom behind booze. And I was never to feel that feeling again until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my freedom has come real slow here in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it really has come through working the third step of AA and working the 11th step in AA. Because that's where I get free. I get free from bondage of myself through God, not through anything else, but through my power, but God as I understand him, or as he understands me. And I came to live with a family out in Palos Verdes, and I was real impressed with this family. I was impressed with her home. She had a beautiful home, and she had a beautiful bar. We didn't have a bar in our house. And she had a beautiful bar in her house. She used to drink 108-proof vodka, and I used to drink 108-proof vodka, and I'd fill a bottle up with water, and then when she drank, she could never understand how come she couldn't get a buzz on. Well, she was drinking that good mountain water that she used to buy, you know. And these people were very good to me, and these people wanted me to go to school, and they didn't. These were people I did go back, and I did make an amends to, and these were people who were very, very grateful. I found a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. They knew there was something wrong with me. They just didn't know what. This woman took me down to Redondo Beach. When I drank, I used to break out. You see, I don't identify with people who drank for 25 years and then crossed over that invisible line. I was alcoholic from the very first time I started drinking. And I used to break out when I got drunk. I used to really break out in welts and all over my body because I was really physically allergic to alcohol. And I'd have to sit in bathtubs of water to try and get these down. And this woman, and I shook a lot, and I was shaking before I came up here tonight. I was afraid I was going to start hyperventilating, and and someone would have to go get me a brown paper bag so I could breathe. And I was so scared. I was just shaking, and this woman wanted me to go to school, and I knew that I couldn't go to school, and I knew that I couldn't go into that office because, see, she never got all the messages, and I knew that I couldn't go into that office and fill out those papers because I was terrified of my peers. I never ran around with my peers. I never had anything to do with my peers, and she found out that I couldn't write that, you know, I would be so humiliated, and all of those secrets and that we all have, and they tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous we were sick as our secrets, and I went down to that Redondo Beach High, and I'm standing outside that office, and I'm shaking just not from the stuff I drank the night before. I'm also shaking because she's going to find out something about me. And I'm standing outside that door. And today I can tell you I was going into a catatonic state of mind with absolute sheer fear that someone's going to find out something about me. And that's the freedom I have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life's an open book. There isn't anything I'm not afraid to tell you about me. If you want to know something about me, you come and ask me. And that's the freedom I got here because I don't have to hide anything anymore. I can share with you what's going on in my life, and I don't have to, and I can be accepted by telling you that it's okay. I'm all right. I'm just exactly where I'm supposed to be in my life. And that woman looked at me and she said, "You don't have to do this," and I didn't have to do it. And I started running around Redondo Beach Pier, and I started running around a lot of people who used a lot of hard drugs, and this in the 60s. And I never got involved in drugs, and the only reason I didn't get involved in drugs is simply because I was terrified if I was caught, I would be deported back to Ireland, and my father would meet me at Dublin Airport, and he'd kill me first and ask questions later. And my father caught me smoking when I was 10 years of age. My grandmother turned me on to cigarettes. I hate telling this story. My grandmother was an invalid, and she was paralyzed down the left side, and I used to stop every day after school and see her and make sure she was okay, and she'd ask me for the bedpan. I wouldn't give it to her unless she gave me a cigarette. I was kind of a mean kid, you know. I got nowhere to go back to, you know. And so she taught me how to smoke. And so my dad caught me smoking, and I got the cigarette hanging on my mouth, and I'm saying, "I'm not smoking," you know. And he grabbed me, and he shoved that. I ate that cigarette, and he took a dog's leash to me, and he whipped me, and he kicked me. And my mother ran in and said, "Jack, you're going to kill her." And he said, "Yes, I'm going to kill her. She's no good and never will be any good." And they couldn't let me out of that house for 2 weeks. I was so black and blue. I was whipped like a dog. And they couldn't let me out of that house because I don't know what they would have done in Ireland, you know, but I couldn't go out. I couldn't even look out the window because they didn't want anyone to see what he had done to me. And that memory stayed with me. And I knew that if I was caught, You know, and report back to Ireland, my dad would kill me, and he would ask questions later. And I didn't want that to happen again, because my father was very, very abusive. And it's now, he didn't know any better. He was passing down what was passed down to him, and it just goes on to generation, you know. Yeah, I'm still smoking, and the reason why I keep smoking, and I'm going to give you a good reason here tonight. I've quit a lot of times, but when I quit, I take up stealing. Now, a lot of people take up eating. I take up stealing. And so I decided, you know, it's better to smoke than it is to steal. I stole celery, and I didn't steal until I got sober. Honestly, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't a thief. It wasn't until after I got sober, and then God removed that from me. And when I was 17 years sober, I stopped smoking, and I took up stealing. And I went to Mary Reagan, and I said, God, Mary, I know this piece of celery. You know, I'm not a big thief. You know, celery. I was making tuna salad, and you know, you learn to rationalize a lot better when you're sober. I said, you know, it's a bigger sin. You know, the old Catholic stuff comes up. It's a bigger sin to waste than it is to steal, you know. So I'm going to steal this piece of celery because I don't want the whole thing. I just want one piece of celery to make tuna salad, you know. And I just want a little bit to put in the salad. So I, you know, and I'd quit, and I was standing at the checkout stand right before that. This, my first thing at that time was dentine gum, you know, and I'm standing there, I've got $200 in my wallet, I'm doing the grocery shopping, and the dentine gum's there, and I'm saying, I'm going to take it. No, you're not going to take it. Yes, we are going to take it. No, we're not going to take it. Now, it's all at 55 cents, for crying out loud, you know? So I take the dentine gum, you know, and if you're not a thief, you have no idea, because, you know, the palms of your hands start getting sweaty, and when it used to be just a drink away, now it's just a steal away, you know? I mean, there's a natural high, you know? You just get high. And so then it was the celery, and so then I went to Mary Reagan, and I said, Mary, I said, I'm stealing celery, and she said, you're going to have to go make an amends to the produce man. You know? I said, no, I'm not, Mary. I said, you know, it says we amend to God, to another human being, the exact nature of wrong. I'm telling you what I did, and I'm not going to go tell the produce man I took his goddamn celery, you know. And she said, well, she said, you know, you're going to get caught, and you're going to get in front of one of those judges that know you in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not going to look real good, you know. So I took a little step further. I went to the manager, and I said, you know, I got this problem. And he looked at me and said, what kind of problem? I said, I like to steal. And he said, you like to steal? And I said, yeah. And he said, what do you like to steal? I said, everything. And I said, would you walk around the store with me? I said, I'm a member of AA, and I'm trying to get over this obsession of stealing. I'm trying not to smoke. And if you just walk around the store with me, you know, when I come in here, I'll get better, you know. This is a true story, honestly. I'm surprised the guy didn't call the guys in the white coat with the net come and get me. And so I go in on Thursday morning, and I would see him, and he would walk around the store with me. You know, I'm working on this obsession. I'm trying not to smoke. And then one Thursday I went in, and I saw him. He's looking at me. He's a nice man. And I said, I don't have it today. It's okay. You know, trust me. And I did shop real early in the morning. I like to shop at 6 o'clock in the morning when nobody's out. And and so then one day I'm up at the cash register stand, and I'm this guy, Paul, and I are in the name basis, you know, and the checker, and I went to get my dentine gum, and he said, you quit smoking, Annie? And I said, yeah, I quit smoking. He said, I quit drinking. I said, you did? I said, that's wonderful. I said, I did that some time. And he said, do you know Bill W? And I thought, oh, my God, they got him planted at the market, finally. I want you to know I would never, ever steal a thing from Alpha Beta again, ever. I felt like that AA was watching me, really watching me. So I said, yes, I know Bill W., and left the store, you know. And so I took up smoking again. I thought it's much easier to smoke than it is to try and work that one out. So this woman, I run around Redondo Beach Pier at this time, and I ended up, they went down and told these people they didn't stop serving me, that they would have, they'd have a place to close up. And then I started taking short geographicals. And at this time in my life, and the other thing that I like about being sober is today I had a bath, and I had a shower. Shower this morning, I took a bath this afternoon, and my hair is calm, my makeup's all in the right place, and my clothes is clean. God, isn't that wonderful? And that's not always the way it was. And I don't ever want to forget that this is not the way it always been for me. I used to walk along Redondo Beach Pier and walk along Catalina Avenue, and I drank everything and anything you ever bought me, but when I bought, I drank Ripple. Now, I don't know if you've got any Ripple drinkers here tonight. I'm going to tell you, it was 37 cents a bottle, and it came in a long neck bottle, and if you never got drunk on Ripple, you've missed a trip. You really, truly missed a trip because, and you were cheated because you drink water and the next day and you get two drunks for the price of one if you drink water, you know. And I used to walk along Catalina, and at that time I used to wear rubber go heads, no pair of blue jeans, and no t-shirt, and I gave all the cars a finger. I hated everybody. Hated everybody. And I did. Didn't want anything to do with you Americans because all you ever talked about was education. Now, whether you did or you didn't, in my mind, that's what you did. And I didn't want anything to do with you Irish because all they did was change address and to be the same way here as it did over there, and I didn't want to be Irish, you know. And I used to have this paper sack, and I don't think I would consider myself a wino. I guess I would be a winette, you know, with this paper sack and my little bottle of Ripple wine in it. And so I got involved with Mexicans over there in Torres Lomita, and I like Mexicans, Don. And I learned to speak Spanish like a native to their tongue. It's, got involved with a group of Mexicans over there, and they used to call me Annie the Irish Mexican. And if there's anything, one of my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Angie, many years ago, we sat down and we dissected the two nationalities and what we came up with. The only difference between the Irish and the Mexicans is that we ate potatoes and they ate beans, you know. They drink hard, love hard, beat the hell out of you on Saturday night whether you need it or not, you know. So I got involved with this group over there in Torrance, and I was only drinking in the afternoon at this time of my life, and this guy introduced me to the morning drink. And he was drinking in the morning, and so he introduced me to the morning drink, and I didn't have a job. I didn't have a big resume for jobs, and I don't know, someone else always had to pick up the tab for me, and it was a very, very exciting time in my life, and was getting beat up and jumping out of cars, you know. I mean, it was just absolutely very, very exciting. And I got to thinking one day, and Norm Alpey says, when you drink, don't think. And I got to thinking, and that's one of the things my sponsor keeps telling me, has told me throughout the years. They got that sign that says, think, think, think. And I would think, 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 and I'd call her up, and she said, dude, that's not, sign is not for you, Annie. That's for everybody else but you. You do not think, do not do no thinking, because you do not think like other people think. So don't think. Stop thinking. So I ignored that sign because it's not for me. My sponsor told me I cannot think. And I thought, I got thinking, and I got to thinking, I've been running around with this guy a long time, we ought to get married, you know, and I don't know whether it was leap year, but I was going to propose anyway. And so I took a half a gallon of Red Mountain wine, I got drunk, and I didn't own a driver's license, so I was 4.5 years sober in AA, and I got out on that road, and I started hitchhiking a ride, and I drove to Torrance Alameda, and I found him. And now you could smell me long before you could see me, and I proposed to him, and he looked at me, and he laughed, and he said, I wouldn't marry you if you handed me on a silver platter. My next thought was, I'm going to kill you, son of a bitch, because one less Mexican in this world, we'll all be better off. You know, I don't know how you handle rejection. I don't handle it real well, drunk or sober, you know. And I got him in the car that night, and I got pictures of this car, and I got him in the car, and I got him on the Harbor Freeway. And I turned the wheel of that car in the Harbor Freeway, and you see the insanity is that I wasn't going to get hurt. I was just going to get rid of him, and I was going to walk away from this thing free. And I turned the wheel of that car, and I took 25 feet of guardrail, and went down 30 feet in the embankment, and I crushed my ribs, and I ended up in the hospital, and he ended up in the hospital. I thought I killed me a Mexican. And what I learned out of that experience is, if you're going to kill one Mexican, you got to kill the whole family. Yeah. For some strange reason, they know. For some strange reason, even if they do call you Andy the Irish Mexican, they, you know, when it comes to family, it's a whole different deal, you know. And it just didn't work. And I ended up in the hospital, and I almost died. I almost died. There were some things happening at that time that I can't discuss from the podium, and just the way it is. And there was a reason, the insanity behind trying to kill him. There was a lot of stuff that was going on, and I had really justified and rationalized that it was okay to do that. And I almost died. I wanted to die. I was 19 years of age, and I wanted to die. Life was over for me, and it was too hard. And they called the priest in. I had gone to see this priest over at St. Lawrence's because I knew there was something wrong with me. I was seeing psychiatrists. I was trying to get help. I didn't know that alcohol had anything to do with what was going on in my life. I really, truly did not know that. And this woman came down, these people came down from the hill, and they wanted to send a letter to, they wanted to send a telegram to my people and have them sign so they could do surgery on me because I was bleeding internally, and they figured that I would probably bleed to death. And I said no, that my mother and father would not understand, and I just rather, I didn't care whether I lived or I died. And so they called these people in, and they said no, they were no longer responsible for me. And that priest came over to that hospital, and he gave me the last rites, and he sat by the bed, and he handed me a rosary, and he told me that if I died that night, that surely there I would burn in the fires of hell because of some of the things that was going on in my life. And I took that rosary and I threw that rosary from that man and I said, you take your God and you take your rosary and get the hell out of my life. Because if there is such a place called hell, I'm living it. I'm living it right between my ears. And I really believe that that's when I really lost any sight of any hope if there were any God in my life. And I got out of that hospital, and I couldn't let go of that situation, and I stayed in that situation, and it continued to get worse. And there was a lot of real things in me that I don't have today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had a relationship with anybody, whether it be a girlfriend or whether it be with a man or whoever, even the people I came to. That man was a very well-educated man, him and his wife, and they didn't beat on their children, they spanked their children. And he ended up hitting me one day, and he was absolutely, totally appalled at the fact that he would ever hit anybody. Inside of me, that if you didn't hit me, you didn't love me. And that's a real sick kind of thinking. I ended up down in Long Beach one time, and I got very belligerent and very drunk, and I was always in that state of mind. And I said I started to yell cop. Mexicans do not like you to yell cop. You know, they can yell cop, but you can't yell cop. And I ran out to the phone booth to yell a cop, to call the cops on him. And I was in the phone booth, and he kicked the door, and he kicked me, and I yelled, Uncle. And I called out of that phone booth. You see, I know there's normal people do not put up with that kind of stuff, and they will run from this. But I don't know what normal is. The only place I ever get to see normal is on my dishwasher, washer, and dryer. It says normal cycle, you know. Now, I like to think I'm the delicate cycle. And so I crawl out of that phone booth, and I go back into the bar I was at, and I said, let's have a drink, and we'll discuss this. Because, you see, I will stay somewhere forever because I'm absolutely, totally terrified of being abandoned or being left alone. And I don't care what you do to me, just don't leave me. I've had to experience that here in Alcoholics Anonymous when you come in and you meet new people and you get to know the people and then they move on and to go out of the area. But I know today they don't abandon me. They just have to go on to do what they're going to do in their sobriety. And so the other thing was that it talks about me in step 8 and the 12 and 12. It says about bringing out the finer character defects in other people. I was a master bringing out the finer character defects in people. I antagonized you until you had no other way to go but to hit me. Because you see, I wanted you to hit me simply because I thought if you hit me hard enough, you'd kill this part of me that kept screwing up. Now, in the 25 years that I've been sober, nobody has found it necessary to hit me here in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know that if you kill that part of me, you kill all of me, because that's the part of me you love here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the part of me that keeps bringing me back here. I ended up in Arizona, in Prescott, Arizona, with this guy. And I was at Prescott, and it was a little Mexican community, and I got drunk, and I was in a blackout, and I said some stuff to this guy's wife, and I don't know what I said to his wife. Mexicans do not like you to talk to their wives in the way I talk to them either. And I left that little situation and went out to the backseat of a car to pass out, and 4 Mexican men came out after me, and they pulled me out of the backseat of the car, and they worked me over good, and I almost got my wish. And they got me down on that dirt road, and this guy said, I'll go get the truck, and we're talking in Spanish, and they went and got the truck, and as the truck came and the headlights were coming, these 3 guys jumped off of me, and I don't know to this day where I got the sense to roll off of that dirt road, but I rolled off of that dirt road, and I got up off that dirt road as that truck went past me, and those guys scattered, and I walk along the dirt road, and my hair is full of gravel, my face looks like a mag truck has run over, and I need a drink. And I am the type of drunk, I live by 4 mailboxes or Ralph's Market or some sign, and I have no idea where I am. And I'm somewhere in Arizona, I'm never going to make it back to Los Angeles again. And the guy comes along, and he picks me up, and we go to a liquor store, and we pick up a bottle, and we go to a dirty motel, and that's how I learned to solve my problems. I have no idea how to solve my problems until I come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you talked a great deal about dying. I know what it's like to die. I know what it's like to die when you're new and you're sitting out there and you get to that part of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you say, and you have to let go of all of your old ideas. I would literally die. Part of me, my stomach, I'd just get tight and I think, let go of all my old ideas, I will die. The only old idea I believe I had to let go at that time was the old idea that I could drink normally, because I cannot drink normally. But I could not let go of any of my old ideas. And I am truly grateful that those people knew how far down that scale I'd gone and knew that I would have to spoon feed me Alcoholics Anonymous a little at a time so I could learn to trust and try some of your new ideas. And if I hadn't tried some of your new ideas, I would have missed a whole lot of stuff here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a little place in Gardena, a little room, and I used to call it my 4x4. I had a hot plate and had a sink and had cockroaches and had a gal named Annie, and it was $10 a week, and I could never come up with that $10 a week. And I used to, in that little room, I died 1,000 times in that little room. I just ran through people. People did not want to be around me because I was a troubled drunk. And I got into fights, and I started fights, and I got people all wound up, and I always ended up by myself. And in that little room, I lay in bed one night, sucking off a vodka bottle, screaming at the top of my lungs, I want someone to understand me. I want one lousy person to understand me. Why isn't there somebody that can understand me? And I got out of that bed, and I put on all those, that old pair of rubber go-aheads and that old pair of jeans and that old T-shirt, and I head out in Western Avenue, and I'm here to tell you I always found somebody. And it always lasts for a very, very short time. It always ended the same way. I got beat up and left to my own self. And that little room, I lived there for 6 months, and the only time I was ever free of what was going on inside of me was under the influence of alcohol. I couldn't get down the hall to take a shower. I had to go down the hall to take a shower, and I never got down there because I'd start drinking to get the courage to go down the hall to take a shower, and I always overshoot the mark, so I never went down and took a shower. Two girls came into my life at that time, and one girl's name was Carol Poole, and Carol taught me how to write my name, and Ann Wilson, and I had a paper sack, and I had a green card, and that's all I owned, and they moved me, I moved to Long Beach, and I thought if I could just get away from this group of Mexicans, I would be okay, you know, I will be all right, things will be better, and I moved over to Long Beach, and I ended up in Anaheim Street, and the galley came off of Beacon Street in Anaheim, and I ended up in Beacon Street in San Pedro, and then I was down in Anaheim for 8 months, and I don't think I could have done any more than 8 months in Anaheim. And while I was down there, the skinny, puny little guy came down there, and he asked me to go out. Now, you could smell me long before you could see me, and he asked me he'd like to take me out, and I asked him if he had a job. And he said, no, he didn't work. And I said, I don't date guys who don't work. It's real important you have a job. I'm really having a hard time supporting myself. I most certainly don't wish to support you. And so he went out and got himself a job, and 6 weeks later he gave me two black eyes, and I knew we were in love, and we got married, you know. And I had two of the blackest eyes I've ever seen in my life, you know. And he took me back to Minnesota, and he was going to be my savior, and things were going to be different, and they were different. He started taking bottles out of my purse, and he started telling me when I could drink and when I couldn't drink. I didn't like his family. I met his mother. Both his parents are dead, and they were very, very nice people. And his mother didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She didn't gossip. She went to church on Sunday. She didn't screw around. I had absolutely nothing in common with this woman. And I thought, my God, I should have checked this guy out a little bit better than I did. You know, what am I doing here? And the only one his whole family liked was his sister. And she was an alcoholic, and she drank like I did. And she just celebrated 24 years in Alcoholics Anonymous on the 22nd of September. And God saw fit, after I had a year of sobriety, to go back and take her to her first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I, 5 months into this marriage, I decided I made a terrible mistake and that I ought to get back to California and find that Mexican who really loved me and get rid of this guy, you know. And so we came back to California. I had another one of those brainstorms. I decided what I needed was a baby. Because someone told me that when you have a baby, you automatically grow up. Well, they lied one more time. And so I got pregnant, and 5 minutes after I'm pregnant, I don't want to be pregnant anymore. And the doctor put me in beer and wine. I said one beer a day and one glass of wine a day, and I was having a six-pack a day and half a gallon. And I spent that 9 months by the toilet bowl, and there was 5 other girls in that apartment building that had babies, and they went in and had their babies, and they came home, and they were all really happy, and I have to believe that they were normal, or they were just well-adjusted or whatever, and they just seemed to be doing real good. And I went in, and I knew that was going to happen for me, and I went in, and I had my baby, and they put that baby in my arms, and God, I'd like to tell you that I, you know, fell in love, and I was going to take care of her, and what I have is an overwhelming feeling of responsibility, and what do we do now, you know, and I didn't get that feeling of, I'm going to love you and protect you forever. That girl's 27 years of age, and I love her very, very much, and she is so good to me, and she's just an absolute beautiful girl. And I'd like to take credit for her, and I can't, because I owe that to the women in AA. I owe it to AA. I owe it to the women in AA, that the mommies that came to me and taught me how to be a mommy in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't know how to be a mommy. I didn't have to do anything when I got here. Everything, my life started when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took that baby home, and I wanted to be a good mommy. Whatever good mommy is, I wanted to be it. And I didn't know how to do it. And very quickly go into abuse, and I did the same thing. So it was done to me, I did to her, and I started beating on her, and a tiny little baby, and many, many nights my husband had to take me off of her, and I started to leave home, and I'd take off, and I'd be gone, and I couldn't stay home. I just couldn't. I had to get out there, and I had to get out there in those streets, and I had to get back to Long Beach, and I didn't know how to react to anybody doing anything, being kind to me, and so then he started threatening me, and he told me that if I didn't do something about my drinking, he was going to take that little girl, and take her away, and that's when I first came to AA, and when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous on June 16th, I don't ever want to forget that morning. I don't ever want to forget it. I don't ever want to forget any part of my life. I don't want to live it anymore. I don't want to have to go back and relive any part of my life. And on June 16th, 1968, after a four-day run, there I was with these two people, and both of the people that I went on that four-day run with was Billy Dee and Leona Williams from Long Beach, and they're both dead, and they died horrible deaths, and they died from alcoholism, died of cirrhosis, and I was gone out for 4 days, and I came home, and I was pretty beat up, and because he learned enough in that short time that I gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, that there was no point in chasing me down in bars anymore. There was no point in picking me up off the bathroom floor. They might as well just let me run. And I ran it till I couldn't run it anymore. And I sat in that chair, and they tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous, that was my moment of clarity. And I saw where I was going, and I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go back to North Long Beach, nor did I want to go back to Anaheim Street. And I didn't want to, you know, I knew that those were the places I was going to go back to. And he sat at the other end of the couch. And that little girl stood at the other end of the couch, and her little legs were all black and blue, and her little eyes were sunken in her head, and her diaper was half off. And I just sat there, and I hung my head, because I got beaten up real bad the night before from somebody else's husband. And I ended up there, I told her, I said, I'm going to go try Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I'm going to call that gal that wants to be my friend. And he said, you go ahead. He said, you've never completed anything in your life. He said, you won't stay there either. And I said, I'm not doing it for you, and I'm not doing it for her. I got to go see you. I can't stand to live inside of me no more. And Carolyn came and got me and took me to my first meeting of AA. And I sat my hands and I shook and I shook. And I had the horrible dry heaves. And I wanted 10 years and 10 minutes. I just wanted somebody, you know, to fix me. You know, just fix me and fix me fast. And, you know, just stop my head from racing and take this knot out of the pit of my gut and make these shakes go away and I'll be okay. And that's what I wanted that Sunday morning. And the man stood up here like I am tonight, and he told me what I suffered from, and he told me I had a threefold disease. It was an allergy to the body, covering an obsession to the mind, and that I was spiritually sick, and I never knew how spiritually sick I was, you know, and that's part of the deal here for me. I believe what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, so I have a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual maintenance, nothing more, nothing less. It also goes on to tell me in the ABCs that no human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. There isn't one of you in here that can relieve me of my alcoholism, but God could and would if I seek him on a daily basis. And I do that on a daily basis, because that's all there's left after you're here for a while on Alcoholics Anonymous, is to broaden that spiritual life, and you can go, it can leaps and bounds. There's no end to that in as far as I'm concerned today. Now, you couldn't have told me that when I was new in AA. I didn't want anything to do with him. And the man told me that it was the first drink that got me drunk. And I never knew it was the first drink that got me drunk. And he told me that I could get sober and stay sober the same way I drank. And I was a daily drinker and a periodic drunk. I drank every day, but I got drunk one or two times during the week. And I left that meeting and I wanted to drink more than anything in my life I wanted to drink. I could taste it. I could taste it. And I knew that if I had a drink, I would stop my head from racing and take the knot out of the pit of my gut and make the shakes go away. And I heard the man say, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. And I went to another meeting, went to a lot of meetings. And 9 months sober, I was 9 months pregnant. And in that 9 months, I wanted to drink more than anything. I kept putting it off. And when I gave birth to that baby boy, I knew that it was going to be different. It was all going to be different because now I'm sober, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't any different for him, and it wasn't any different for that husband, and it wasn't any different for that little girl, because I was just as insane sober as I was drunk, in fact, more. And so what happened when I gave birth to that baby boy was that God removed the obsession for alcohol from me, and I could admit it to my own self that I was an alcoholic, and that's the first step in recovery, and the obsession was removed from me. I wasn't obsessing on it anymore, and I took that baby boy home, and I wanted to be a good mommy, and I tried real hard to be a good mommy. And I wasn't doing a real good job of it. I found I was pregnant again, and I got three children, and I got three really, really neat children, and I owe it to AA. I owe it to you. I owe it to the women of Alcoholics Anonymous and the men in AA. I can't stand here and tell you that I did this all on my own. You know, and none of my children My son has all the predisposition of alcoholism. He just seems to be doing real well with it, and I don't badger him about it, and he knows where to come whenever he starts getting into a lot of trouble with it. And he doesn't have to get into trouble, but he's enjoying it right now. My oldest girl is 27 years of age. She got married a year ago, and in November she'll be a year married, and she's really good to me, and I got a real, really neat relationship with her. She's a graduate from USC, and I'd like to tell you I did that for her. I didn't. She got out there, and she got scholarships, and she got loans, and she put herself through school. And she's got a wonderful, wonderful spirit, and I'm real close with her. And my son was over in the Army. He did 4 years. He was supposed to do four, but he did 4.5 because he did something over in Korea, and I probably never will know what he did over there. He's not willing to cop, but he was able to call me, he was able to talk to me, and I was able to take some action because of some of the people I know in Alcoholics Anonymous that helped me through that time. And he got home, and he's doing pretty well. You know, he's home. He's home safe, and I was scared that he wasn't going to get home safe. And my youngest daughter just graduated from USC, or from San Diego State, and she's 22 years of age, and she's she's got an Annie attitude, and it kind of scares me, but she's really a neat kid, and she's got a lot of goals, and I look at these kids, and I wonder where they come from, and where they come from, they came through me, and they're really of the people of AA, you know. And these kids didn't get a really easy start, and I want to share with you, and I'll shut up. In the beginning, if you're new here and you're going through some trials, tribulations in your sobriety, for heaven's sakes, don't drink. Just don't drink. That's the bottom. Don't drink. Don't take any pills. Don't use any drugs. Don't smoke any pot. Just keep showing up. I'm going to tell you, it'll work. And it worked for me. I ended up 2.5 years sober. I had great sponsorship, and I believe in sponsorship, and this woman had 5 kids. I still see this woman, Lois. She's 33 years sober, and I still see her on a weekly basis, and I love this woman very, very much, and she was always there for me, and she had 5 children, and every time I call her, she'd come. And I was not an easy person to sponsor. I just was not easy. I was constantly coming out of my skin, and at 2.5 years sober, I beat my son, because you see, I'm getting sicker in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of Weller. I'm getting sicker and sicker and going to a lot of meetings and picking up those ashtrays and doing all the things that I'm asked to do here in the fellowship. But it's not, I'm so emotionally sick. And in fact, they took me to Schizophrenics Anonymous and they took me to some meetings. They didn't know what to do with me, and I didn't know what to do with me. And it wasn't that I wasn't working a program. I was trying. I was trying to do what I was told to do. I just had all this stuff, all this emotion, all this. I didn't know how to deal with it. And I ended up, and I was abusing, and I'd go home, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd tell you what I was doing to my kids, and you would tell me it's okay, and you're sober, just stay sober, and I beat my son, and I beat him till his eyes rolled back on his head, and the man came to my door that day, and he's 10 miles away from home, and he came to my door. Those coincidences, they happen still for me today, I hope they're happening for you. And he took that baby away from me, and he said, you called somebody, and I called somebody, and I was almost 3 years sober, and I, Mary Lee came and got me and took me down to the meeting. I went into the meeting, and I asked you to help me. Please help me. I have to make the 180-degree turn, and you've got to help me. I can't do this. I knew I can't drink. I was told I couldn't drink, and I knew it. I knew that I couldn't drink, and I couldn't take anything else. I've been accused of taking pills. I wasn't taking pills. I wasn't taking anything. The only thing I ever took was Excedrin, and I ended up... Someone said something in that meeting because, you see, you said, you promised me in page 82 and 83 of the big book, or 83 and 84 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this promise is in there. And you promised me if I was pain-taking and doing these things, that these were some of the things that were going to happen for me, that I would intuitively know how to handle situations used to baffle me, that I would comprehend the word serenity, and I'd know peace, and I had no peace. I had no peace. And that fear of people and economic insecurity would leave me. And none of that was happening for me. I was worse now than I was when I got here. And someone said something, and I threw a chair down, and I ran out of the meeting, and a gal named Edna came out after me and grabbed a hold of me. And I'm glad I didn't drive a car, because I think I would have ran into a wall that night. I would have killed somebody or killed myself. And she grabbed a hold of me. And you see, when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a tough person. I was tough, and I got beat up a lot, and I was cold, and I couldn't cry. I didn't want to cry. Crying was for those of you who are real weak, and I wasn't weak. And a guy held me one night while another punched my face, and he wanted me to cry, and I told him to go ahead and kill me because I wasn't going to cry. Tears were no longer, I didn't want to cry anymore. I had cried all I ever wanted to cry in my life. And this guy there was a guy in my home group, his name was Walt Stiles, and I believed that when you learn to love unconditionally, now newcomer, we tell you that we love you unconditionally, but I'm going to tell you they'll only love you unconditionally for the first 30 days, and then after that they want you to work on your character defects. And I believe for me that loving somebody unconditionally is a goal, but there's a guy in my home group with Walt Stiles, and he learned to love unconditionally, and Walt is gone today. And Walt loved me unconditionally, him and his wife Millie, and Walt used to go up to a podium. He's a great big man, and he'd go up to a podium, and he'd start crying, and I'd sit there, and I'd white knuckle, and I'd say, why does Walt cry? I would just, hair would stand on my neck, and I'd say, why does he cry? You know, and I know today why Walt cries. When that night when I ran that meeting, and then they came out after me, and she grabbed a hold of me, and I started to cry. And I started crying, I thought I'd never stop crying. And I know today why God gives us tears. He gives us tears because they are, truly are, the cleansing of one's soul. And you know, I was so full of gratitude. And I cry today sometimes because I'm so happy. And sometimes I cry when I'm real sad. And sometimes I cry because I'm just plain ass feeling sorry for myself. You know? And I give myself 10 minutes on that one. I say, it's okay. Now you got 10 minutes and you felt sorry for yourself. You had your thumb in your mouth and your blanket. Now knock it off, you know? It's time to just keep on going. You know, pick up and go. And it's all okay. There's nothing wrong with crying. And so I cried that night in his arms. And I believe that goes on to talks about that some of us have felt that we were reborn. And I was reborn that night in that woman's arms. And that woman took me to Orange County Psycho. And they didn't keep me to Orange County Psycho, but I was introduced to a psychologist at that time and introduced to a group of women who were child abusers. And I got into that group and I got afraid and they threatened to take my babies away from me. And I didn't stop beating on my children. It took a while. It took a lot of the women in AA. I went to a lot of women's meetings, and it was those women. Those women started to mother me, and they started to nurture me, and taught me how to nurture my own children. I was afraid of my children. I love my children very, very much. I've got a great relationship with all of my children today. It may not be perfect in your eyes, but it's perfect in mine from where we've all come from. And I left them. That woman gave me life, and I felt I was reborn in Edna's arms. And 3 months after she gave me life, she was nine years sober in AA. And I always mention her from a podium because Edna committed suicide 3 months after that. And nobody in Huntington Beach has ever been able to answer me why. And nobody's ever known what was going on in her life. You know, what happened to her? You know, she just committed suicide. That's, she hung herself in her bathroom. And I don't think I ever got to tell her, you know, that what she'd done for me, you know, that she was God's instrument to come and help me and to be there, you know. I never got to tell her. And so I'm telling you, and I tell everybody everywhere I go, I mention Edna from the podium of AA, because that's my way of letting Edna know that she did play a real important part in somebody's life that happened to be mine, you know, and maybe many, many other people. But I remember it, you know, and that's what's important. I remember it, that she was there that night. She was there, and she knew what to do, and came and grabbed me. I ended up, I started to reach and started to touch my children, and I learned to surrender. And you see, I had to surrender. I had to surrender, and Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of surrendering and letting go, and surrendering and let go. And I found a God. I found a God through this man. I went to this doctor for 2.5 years, and I'm not here to give you a plug for a psychiatrist, but I don't know what your big book reads, but my big book says that those professional people are there to help us. And I didn't take any funny little pills. I went to that man, and I went for a purpose, and that man sat with me, and I gave my inventory to him, because I did an inventory, and I took it back, and I pushed it down, and I couldn't let go of it, and I pushed it down, and I pushed it down until all this new stuff started coming in, and I blew, and I lost it. I lost it. And I had to surrender, and I had to start trusting. And I got in touch with a power within me that my life has never been the same. Now, I hear AA talk, people in AA talk about this God. And I knew there was a God, but I was afraid of him. And I, you know, I was afraid to, I said, yes, I have a God. And I've done that third step because you did that third step. And I surrendered, and I got in touch within myself with that power within myself. And I'd like to tell you that God and I have walked hand in hand through all these years, and that would be a lie too, because I like to go sightseeing, you know. I like to kind of bury off the path, you know, and just kind of say, I'm going over here for a little while. And he lets me go over there. And I know where my source of power comes from, and he brings me back, and I get back in because I can't stand the pain. I can't stand when I get so resistant and so stubborn that I have to let go and say, okay, you got it. I got the message. I don't have to bang. You know, it's like 2x4s. He gets me in the back of the neck, and I get up, and I say, do it again. I like that, you know? You know, and so I'm able to let go faster than I've ever been able to let go. I graduated from high school. I've done a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everybody was real happy that I wasn't going to go out to college. They said, what an order, God, don't let us go through it. You know, we can't help her. She's going to drive us crazy. Today I cut hair, and I love cutting hair, and I love to do color, and I've got a nice clientele, and I do very well at what I'm doing. I work for an Al-Anon, and by God, she goes to a lot of Al-Anon meetings because she's got me there in that room, and plus all the other AAs that come. And my life has really, really changed. And I want to share one thing with you, how I found love. And how I found love in Alcoholics Anonymous was through another woman in AA. Nobody had ever asked me to be their sponsor. Nobody. No, I had 3 children. And I had accepted the things I couldn't change. I didn't own that emotion called love. I didn't have it. I knew you had it, but I didn't have it. I didn't have it inside. And it's this French prayer says, we accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I accepted that. And I was able to touch my children. I was able to hug my children. And I stopped abusing my children. It didn't all happen. It took a very slow process. It took a lot of work. And I ended up at 5 years sober. Nobody had ever asked me to be their sponsor. Old-timers just take those newcomers and move them away from me. They were afraid I'd contaminate them. You know? And they'd say, don't listen to Annie. Just get over here. And so I, little gal came into program, 2 of them. In fact, I still sponsor 1 of them, Diane G. And Diane and Cindy came into program, and Cindy asked me to be her sponsor. And I told her I would sponsor her, and I would share with her what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous up to that point in time. And Cindy came into AA one night, and she had used a lot of drugs, a lot of LSD. And she was a little gal that used to, she had beautiful, beautiful blue eyes. I don't know whatever happened to her. She moved, and I kept track of her for a long time, and then all of a sudden, nobody seemed to know where she'd gone. But she had long blonde hair, and she had blue eyes, and she used to sit in meetings, and she used to wrap her legs around her neck, you know. I mean, that's how she sat in meetings. And so she came into a meeting, and there's a word for it, and I can't say it. And so she came into a meeting, and she's sitting over in the corner, and she got her legs wrapped around her neck, and she's hallucinating, and someone came up to me and said, you sponsor Cindy, don't you? And I said, yes. And he said, something wrong with her tonight. She's hallucinating. Go get her. And so I took all of me because I thought, my God, I was so scared. You know, if there's something wrong here. And I walked across that room and I undid her legs, you know, around her neck. And I took her out of the meeting and went into the bathroom and sat down on the floor with her. And I held her. And I couldn't be held when I came to AA. I couldn't let anyone touch me. I didn't want to be hugged, and people come up and I said, don't touch me. Please don't hug me. I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand to be touched. And so I took her in my arms and I held her and I rocked her. And she looked at me with the bluest eyes I've ever seen in anybody. And she said, Annie, you love me so much. I felt love for the first time for another human being. I didn't get it from my babies. I get it from my babies today. But I didn't get it from my little babies and my baby's mom. I was holding that little baby tonight. I told him, I said, I'm getting ready for my grandkids because I missed a lot. I missed a lot with those kids because I was so sick. I was so sick. But you didn't tell me to leave. You didn't tell me I couldn't come back here. You told me to keep coming back. You told me that I couldn't do it. You had faith in me. You encouraged me, and you've always been there for me. And I can't ask for anything more than that, can I? You know? I am... Through that little girl, I've learned that I can love a lot. It was like electricity going through my body because God wanted me to know that I had love and that I could love. And I love a lot of people. I sponsor a lot of girls today in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what really blows me away is they want what I have. And they listen. And they know that I'm not bullshitting them. And I've got the experience and I've gone through a lot of stuff. You know, I'm a woman that came from a lot of abuse. I came from... A lot of child abuse. I came from sexual abuse. I came from physical abuse. I came from spiritual abuse. And through Alcoholics Anonymous and through the people at AA, you know, I walked tall today. I read a lot today, and I read a lot of books, and I read a lot of spiritual books because my spirit is really hungry, and I need to stay in the spirit. I need to really know that God is there, because I lose my faith, and I get scared, and I get to self-will, and I do all the things that you tell me not to do, you know? And there's one book I love to read, and it's called Gabron, and it's a spiritual book. Now, I know all my answers in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I've read any self-help book there is on the market. I've supported all those guys, you know? And I know what the old-timers told me. There, everything I need to know is in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. But I love to read this one. I love to do different meditations in different books, and it's the prophet, and it's Gabron. And Gabron says, there are children come through us, they're not of us. And you see, my children came through me, but they're not of me. And I came through the people I came through, but I'm not of those people that I came through. I'm of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you are the people. You're the ones that have always walked the extra mile with me when nobody else would walk with me. You're the ones that have sat and held my hand when nobody else would sit and hold my hand. You're the ones that have seen an Annie that nobody else could possibly see. And you pull her out, and she walks tall with dignity today, because I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new here tonight, I hope that you get one-fourth of what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I will never, as I stay sober for 100 years, I will never be able to give you back all the stuff you've given me. God bless each and every one of you.